Continent of Lies. Nothing in his earlier life had prepared Pierce for what came next. It beggared belief. A series of synthetic aperture radar scans transmitted by a probe millions of years ago in another galaxy had triggered a diplomatic crisis, threatening world war and civilizational autocide. The hegemony, despite being a science empire, was not the only nation in this age. True world governments were rare. Cumbersome dinosaurs notorious for their absolute top-down corruption and catastrophic failure modes. The stasis tended to discourage them. The hegemony shared their world with the Autonomous Directorate of Zan, a harshly abstemious land of puritanical library scientists, located on a continent which had once been attached to North America and Africa. Sundry secular monarchies, republics, tyrannies, autarchies, and communes, who thought their superpower neighbors mildly insane for wasting so much of their wealth on academic institutions rather than the usual aimless and undirected pursuit of human happiness. And the Kingdom of Blataria, whose inhabitants obeyed the prehistoric prophet Haldane with fanatical zeal, studying the Arthropoda in ecstatic devotional raptures. The hegemony was geographically the largest of the great powers, unified by a set of common filing and monitoring protocols. But it was not a monolithic entity. The authorities of the Western Principality of Stongu, special area of study, the rocky moons of hot Jupiter's NM33, had reacted to the discovery of civilization on the moon of a water giant with a spectacular display of sour grapes, accusing the northeastern Zealandians of fabricating data in a desperate attempt to justify a hit-and-run raid on the hegemony's federal tax base. Quite what the academics of Leng were supposed to do with these funds was never specified, nor was it necessary to say any more in order to get the blood boiling in the seminaries and colleges. Fabricating data had a deadly ring to it in any science empire, much like the words crusade and jihad in the millennium prior to Pierce's birth. Once the accusation had been raised, it could not be ignored, and this presented the hegemony with a major internal problem. "Honored soldier of the Guardians of Time, our gratitude would be unbounded were you to choose to intercede for us," said the speaker for the delegation from the Dean's Lodge that called on his household barely 2 days after the discovery. "We would not normally dream of petitioning your eminence, but the geopolitical implications are alarming." And indeed they were, for the hegemony supplied information to the Autonomous Directorate in return for the boundless supplies of energy harvested by the solar collectors that blanketed the Directorate's inland deserts. Allegations of fabricating data could damage the value of the hegemony's currency. Indeed, the aggressive and intolerant Zan folk might consider it grounds for war, and an excuse for yet another of their tiresome attempts to obtain the vineyards and breadbasket islands of the outer Nesh archipelago. "I will do what I can." Pierce bowed deeply to the delegates, who numbered no less than a round dozen deans and even a vice-chancellor or two. He studiously avoided making eye contact with his father-in-law, who stood at the back. "If you are absolutely sure of the merits of your case, I can consult the library, then testify publicly, insofar as I am authorized to do so. Would that be acceptable?" The vice-chancellor of the Old College of Leng, an institution with a history of over 6,000 years at this point, bowed in return, his face stiff with gratitude. "We are certain of our case, and consequently willing to abide by the word of the Library of the Guardians of Time. Please permit me to express my gratitude once more." After half an hour of formalities, the delegation finally departed. Ziri reemerged from her seclusion to direct the servants and robots in setting the receiving room of their mansion aright. The boys also emerged, showing no sign of understanding what had just happened. "Ziri, I need to go to the final library," Pierce told her, taking her hands in his and watching for signs of understanding.
"Why, that's wonderful, is it not, my lord? Pierce?"
She stared into his eyes.
"Why are you worried?"
Pierce swallowed bitter saliva. "The library is not a place, Ziri. It's a time. It contains the sum total of all recorded human knowledge after the end of humanity. I'm near to graduation. I'm allowed to go there to use it. But it's not safe. Sometimes people who go to the library disappear and don't come back, and sometimes they come back changed. It's not just a passive archive." Ziri nodded, but looked skeptical.
"But what kind of danger can it pose, given the question you're going to put to it? You're just asking for confirmation that we've been honoring our sources. That's not like asking for the place and time of your own death, is it?
I hope you're right, but I don't know for sure. Pierce paused. That's the problem. He raised her hands to his lips and kissed the backs of her fingers. If it must be done, best do it fast. I'll go and find out. I'll be back soon. He stepped back a pace and activated his phone. Agent Trainee Pierce, requesting a library slot. There was a brief pause while the relays stored his message, awaited a transmission slot, then fired them through the time gate to control. Then he felt the telltale buzzing in the vicinity of his left kidney that warned of an incoming wormhole. It opened around him, spinning out and engulfing him in scant milliseconds, almost too fast to see. Then he was no longer standing in the hall of his own mansion, but on a dark plain of artificial limestone, facing a doorway set into the edge of a vast geodesic dome made from some translucent material. The final library. A Brief Alternate History of the Solar System, Part 3. Slide 11. 100 billion years will pass. Earth orbits a mere 20 million kilometers from its necrosun in this epoch, and the fires of the accretion disk are banked. Continents jostle and shudder, rising and falling, as the lights strobe around their edges, and occasionally in low equatorial orbit, whenever the stasis permits a high-energy civilization to arise. By the end of the first 1 billion years of the voyage, the night skies are dark and starless. The naked eye can still, barely if it knows where to look, see the Chaos Galaxy formed by the collision of M31 and the Milky Way, but it is a graveyard, its rocky planets mostly supernova-sterilized ice balls ripped from their parent stars by one close encounter too many. Unicellular life, once common in the Milky Way at least, has taken a knock. Multicellular life, much rarer, has received a mortal body blow. Only the Stasis's lifeboat remains. Luna still floats in terrestrial orbit. It is a useful tool to stir Earth's liquid core. Prone to a rocky sclerosis, the Earth's heart is a major problem for the Stasis. They can't let it harden, lest the subduction cycle and the deep carbon cycle on which the biosphere depends grind to a halt. But there are ways to stir it up again. They can afford to wait 500 million years for the Earth to cool, then reseed the reborn planet with archaea and algae. After the first fraught experiment in re-terraforming, the Stasis find it sufficient to reboot the mantle and outer core once every 10 billion years or so. The universe changes around them, slowly but surely. At the end of 100 billion years, uranium no longer exists in useful quantities in the Earth's crust. Even uranium-238 decays eventually, and 21 half-lives is more than enough to render it an exotic memory, like the bright and early dawn of the universe. Other isotopes will follow suit, leaving only the most stable behind. The Stasis have sufficient for their needs, and might even manufacture more, were it necessary, using the Necrostar's ergosphere as a forge. But the Stasis don't particularly want their clients to possess the raw materials for nuclear weapons. Better by far to leave those tools by the wayside. The sky is dark. The epoch of star formation has drawn to a close in the galaxies the Earth has left. No bright new stellar nurseries glitter in the void. All the bright, fast-burning suns have exploded and faded. All the smaller main-sequence stars have bloated into dyspeptic ruddy giants, then exhausted their fuel and collapsed. Nothing bright remains save a scattering of dim red-and-white dwarf stars. Smaller bodies, planets, moons, and comets, are slowly abandoning their galaxies, shed from stars as their orbits become chaotic, then ejecting at high speed from the galaxy itself in the wake of near encounters with neighboring stars. Like gas molecules in the upper atmosphere of a planet warmed by a star, the lightest leave first. But the process is inexorable. The average number of planets per star is falling slowly. About those gas molecules, the Stasis have, after some deliberation, taken remedial action. Water vapor is split by ultraviolet light in the upper atmosphere, and the Earth can ill afford to lose its hydrogen. A Soletta now orbits between Earth and the Necrosun, filtering out the short-wavelength radiation, and when they periodically remelt the planet to churn the magma, they are at pains to season their new-made hell with 1,000 cometary hydrogen carriers. But eventually more extreme measures will be necessary. The sky is quiet and deathly cold. The universe is expanding, and the wavelength of the cosmic microwave background radiation has stretched, The temperature of space itself is now only thousandths of a degree above absolute zero. The ripples in the background are no longer detectable, and the distant quasars have reddened into invisibility. Galactic clusters that were once at the far edge of detection are now beyond the cosmic event horizon, and though Earth has only traveled 200 million light-years from the local group, the gulf behind it is nearly a billion light-years wide. This is no longer a suitable epoch for science empires, for the dynamic universe they were called upon to study is slipping out of sight. Slide 12. A trillion years will pass. The universe beyond the Necrosun's reach is black. Far behind it, the final stars of the local group have burned out. White dwarfs have cooled to the temperature of liquid water. Red dwarfs have guttered into chilly darkness. Occasionally, stellar remnants collide. Then the void is illuminated by flashes of lightning, titanic blasts of radiation as the supernovae and gamma-ray bursters flare. But the explosions are becoming rare. Now it isn't just planets that are migrating away from the chilly corpses of the galaxies. Stellar remnants are ejected into the void as the galaxies themselves fall apart with age. Space is empty and cold, barely above absolute zero. The Necrostar's course has passed through what was once the Bootes void, but there is no end to the emptiness in sight. There are voids in all directions now. The Stasis and their clients have abandoned the practice of astronomy. They maintain a simple radar watch in the direction of travel, sending out a gigawatt ping every year against the tiny risk of a rogue asteroid, but they haven't encountered an extrasolar body larger than a grain of sand for billions of years. As for the Necrosun's planetary attendants, one day they will burn Jupiter to keep themselves warm, and Saturn and icy Neptune, water bunker for the oceans of Earth. These days have not yet come, for they are still working through the Titans, through Rhea and Oceanus, Crius and Hyperion, the brown dwarfs built with Sol's stolen mass, and the other dwarfs stolen from the Milky Way during the long burn. Each brown dwarf burns for many times the age of the universe at the birth of humanity. Black holes are nothing if not efficient. But one day they will be used up, the last Titan reduced to a dwarfish cinder, and it will be time to start eating the planets. Not long thereafter, it will be time for the final reseeding. Spin control. Pierce stood uncertainly before the door in the dome. It glowed blue-green with an inner light, and when he looked around, his shadow stretched into the night behind him.
"Don't wait outside for too long," someone said waspishly. "The air isn't safe."
The air? Pierce wondered as he entered the doorway. The glassy slabs of an airlock slid aside and closed behind him, thrice in rapid succession. He found himself in a spacious vivarium, illuminated by a myriad of daylight-bright lamps shining from the vertices of the dome wall's triangular segments. There were plants everywhere, green and damp-smelling cycads, and ferns, and crawling, climbing vines. Insect life hidden in the undergrowth creaked and rattled loudly. Then he noticed the librarian, who stood in the clearing before the doors, as unnaturally still as a plastinated corpse.
"I haven't been here before," Pierce admitted as he approached the robed figure. "I've used outlying branches, but never the central library itself."
"I know."
The librarian pushed back the hood of his robe to reveal a plump, bald head, jowly behind its neat goatee, and gimlet eyes that seemed to drill straight through him. Pierce stopped, uncertain.
"Do I know you?"
"Almost certainly not. Call me Tork, or Librarian."
Tork pointed to a path through the vegetation.
"Come, walk with me. I'll show you to your reading room, and you can get started. You might want to bookmark this location in case you need to return."
Pierce nodded. "Is there anybody else here?"
"Not at present."
Tork sniffed.
"You and I are the only living human beings on the planet right now, although there may be more than one of you present. You have the exclusive use of the library's resources this decade, within reason."
"Within reason?"
"Sometimes our supervisors, yours or mine, take an interest. They are not required to notify me of their presence."
There was a fork in the path, around a large outcropping of some sort of rock crystal, like quartz. Tork turned left.
"Ah, here we are. This is your reading room, Student Agent Pierce."
A white-walled, roofless cubicle sat in the middle of a clearing, through which ran a small brook, its banks overgrown with moss and ferns. The walls were only shoulder-high, a formality and a signifier of privacy. They surrounded a plain wooden desk and a chair.
"This is everything?" Pierce asked, startled.
"Not entirely. Look up."
Tork gestured at the dome above them.
"In here, we maintain a human-compatible biosphere to reprocess your air and waste. We provide light and heat, although the latter is less important than it will be in a few million years hereabouts. We've turned down the sun to conserve mass, but it's still radiating brightly in the infrared. The real problems will start when we work through the last bunker reserve in about 18 million years. The dome should keep the library accessible to readers for about 30 million years after that. Well into Fimbul winter."
Fimbul winter. The winter at the end of the world, after the last fuel for the Necrosun's accretion disk had been consumed, leaving Earth adrift in orbit around a cold black hole, billions of light-years from anything else. Pierce shivered slightly at the thought of it.
"What's the problem with the outside air?"
"We were losing hydrogen too fast, and without hydrogen, there's no water. And without water, we can't maintain a biosphere. And without a biosphere, the planet rapidly becomes less habitable. No free oxygen, for one thing. So about 30 billion years ago, we deuterated the biosphere as a conservation measure. Of course, that necessitated major adjustments to the enzyme systems of all the life forms from bacteria on up. And you, and I, are not equipped to run on heavy water. The stuff's toxic to us."
Tork pointed at the stream.
"You can drink from that if you like, or order refreshments by phone. But don't drink outside the dome. Don't breathe too much if you can help it."
Pierce looked around.
"So this is basically just a reading room, like a branch library. Where's the real library? Where are the archives?"
"You're standing on them."
Tork's expression was one of restrained impatience. "Weren't you paying attention in class the day they covered this?"
"The plateau this reading room is built on, in fact, the entire upper crust, is riddled with storage cells of memory diamond, beneath a thin crust of sedimentary rock laid down to protect it. We switched the continental drift cycle off for good about 5 billion years ago, after the last core cooling cycle. That's when we began accumulating the library deposits."
"Oh." Pierce looked around.
"Well, I suppose I'd better get started. Do you mind?"
"Not at all."
Tork turned his back on Pierce and walked away.
"I'll be around if you call me," he sent.
Pierce sat down in front of the empty desk and laid his hands palm down on the blotter. A continent of memory diamond? The mere idea of that much data beggared the imagination.
"It'll be in here somewhere," he muttered, and smiled.
Unhistory. One of the first things that any agent of the stasis learns is patience. It's not as if they are short of time. Their long lives extend beyond the easy reach of memory, and should they avoid death through violence or accident or suicide, they can pursue projects that would exceed the life expectancy of ordinary mortals. And that is how they live in the absence of the principal aspect of their employment, the ability to request access to the time gate. Pierce thought at first that the Vice Chancellor's request would be trivial, a matter of taking a few hours or days to dig down into the stacks and review the historical record. He'd return triumphant, a few minutes upstream of his departure, and present his findings before the Council. Ziri would be appropriately adoring, and would doubtless write a series of sonnets about his library visit, for poetics were in fashion as the densest rational format for sociological academic case studies in Leng. And his adoptive home time would be spared the rigor and pity of a needless doctrinal war. That was his plan. It came unglued roughly a week after his arrival, at the point when he stopped flailing around in increasing panic and went for a long walk around the paths of the biome, brooding darkly, trying to quantify the task. Memory diamond is an astonishingly dense and durable data substrate. It's a lattice of carbon nuclei, like any other diamond, save that it is synthetic, and the position of atoms in the lattice represents data. By convention, an atom of carbon-12 represents a zero, and an atom of carbon-13 represents a one, and 12.5 grams of memory diamond, one molar weight, a little under half an old-style ounce, stores 6 by 10 to the 23rd power bits of data, or 10 to the 23rd power bytes, with compression. The continent the reading room is situated on is 15 kilometers thick and covers an area of just under 40 million square kilometers, comparable to North and South America combined in the epoch of Pierce's birth. Half of it is memory diamond. There's well over 10 to the 18 power tons of the stuff, roughly 10 to the 23rd power molar weights. One molar weight of memory diamond is sufficient to hold all the data ever created and stored by the human species prior to Pierce's birth, in what was known at the time as the 21st century. The civilizations over which the stasis held sway for a trillion years stored a lot more data. And when they collapsed, the stasis looted their Alexandrian archives, binged on stolen data, and vomited it back up at the far end of time. Pierce's problem was this. More than 90% of the library consisted of lies. He'd started out, naturally enough, with two pieces of information, the waypoint in his phone that identified the exact location of the porch of his home in Leng, and the designation of the planetary system in M33 that had aroused such controversy. It was true, as Ziri had said, that the hegemony was reveling in the feed from the robot exploration fleet that had swept through the Triangulum Galaxy tens of millions of years ago. And he knew, he was certain, that Ziri and the hegemony and the city of Leng with its Mediterranean airs and absurdly scholastic customs existed. He had held her as his wife and lover for nearly two decades objective, dwelt there and followed their ways as an honorable, noble guest for more than 10 of those years. He could smell the hot, damp summer evening breeze in his nostrils, the scent of the climbing blue rose vines on the trellis behind his house. The first time he gave the library his home address and the identities to search for, it took him to a set of war grave records in the Autonomous Directorate, 2 years before his first interview with Ziri. He was unamused to note the names of his father and mother-in-law inscribed in the list of terrorist wreckers and resistors who had been liquidated by the Truth Police in the wake of the liberation of Leng by Directorate forces. He tried again. This time he was relieved to home in on his return from the field trip to Constantinople, seen through the omnipresent eyes of Ziri's own cams, but was perplexed by her lack of excitement. He backtracked, his search widening out until he discovered to his surprise that according to the library, the hegemony was not in fact investigating the Triangulum Galaxy at all, but focusing on Mafe 1, 7 million light-years farther out. That night he ordered up 2 bottles of a passable Syrah and drank himself into a solitary stupor for the first time in some years. It was a childish and short-sighted act, but the repeated failures were eating away at his patience. The day after, wiser but somewhat irritable, he tried again, entering his home coordinates into the desk and asking for a view of his hall. There was no hall, and indeed no Leng, and no hegemony either, but the angry spear-wielding raccoons had discovered Woad. Pierce stood up, shaking with frustration, and walked out of the reader's cubicle. He stood for a while on the damp green edge of the brook, staring at the play of light across the running water. It wasn't enough. He shed his scholar's robe heedlessly, turned to face the dirt trail that had led him to this dead end, and began to run. Arriving at the entrance airlock, he didn't stop. His legs pounded on, taking him out of the dome and then around it in a long loop, feet thumping on the bony limestone pavement, each plate like the scale of a monstrous fossilized lizard beneath his feet. He kept the glowing dome to his left as he circled it, once, then twice. By the end of the run, he was flagging, his chest beginning to burn, the hot, heavy lassitude building in his legs as the sweat dripped down his face. He slowed to a walk as the airlock came into view again. When he was ready to speak, he activated his phone. "Torque, your fucking library is lying to me. Why is that?"
"Ah, you've just noticed."
Torque sounded amused.
"Come inside and we'll discuss it."
"I don't want to discuss it. I want it to work," Pierce fumed to himself as he trudged back to the airlock. Overhead, 3 planets twinkled redly across the blind vault of the nighttime sky. Torque was waiting for him in the clearing, holding a bottle and a pair of shot glasses.
"You're going to need this," he said, a twinkle in his eyes. "Everybody does the first time around." "Feh."
Pierce shuffled stiffly past him, intending to return to the reading cubicle. "What use is a library full of lies?"
"They're not lies."
Torque's response was uncharacteristically mild.
"They're unhistory."
"Un—" Pierce stopped dead in his tracks. "There was no unhistory in the branch libraries I used," he said tonelessly.
"There wouldn't be. Have you given thought to what happens every time you step through a time gate?"
"Not unduly. What does that have to do with everything? Torque allowed a note of irritation to creep into his voice.
You need to pay more attention to theory, Agent. Not all problems can be solved with a knife.
Huh. So the library is contaminated with unhistory because...
Students. When you use a time gate, you enter a wormhole, and when you exit from it, well, from the reference frame of your point of emergence, a singularity briefly appears and emits a large gobbet of information. You. The information isn't consistent with the time leading up to its sudden appearance. Causality may be violated for one thing, and for another, the information, the traveler, may remember or contain data that wasn't there before. You're just a bundle of data spewed out by a wormhole. You don't have to be consistent with the universe around you. That's how you remember your upbringing and your recruitment, even though nobody else does. Except for the library.
They came to a clearing, and instead of taking the track to the reading room, Torque took a different path.
Let's suppose you visit a temporal sector, call it A1, and while you're there, you do something that changes its historical pattern. You're now in sector A2. A1 no longer exists. It's been overwritten. If there's a branch library in A1, it's now in A2, and it too has changed, because it is consistent with its own history. But the real library... Tell me, how does information enter the library?
Pierce floundered. I thought that was an archival specialty. Every 5 seconds throughout eternity, a listener slot opens for a millisecond, and anything of interest is sent forward to control.
Not exactly.
Torque stopped on the edge of another clearing in the domed jungle.
The communication slots send data backward in time, not forward. There's an epoch almost 1 billion years long, sitting in the Archean and Proterozoic eras, where we run the library relays. The point is, back in the Cryptozoic relay era, there are no palimpsests. There's no human history to contaminate. Nothing there but a bunch of store and forward relays. So reports from Sector A1 are relayed back to the Cryptozoic, as are reports from Sector A2. And when they're transmitted uptime to the final library for compilation, we have 2 conflicting reports from Sector A.
Pierce boggled. Are you telling me that we don't destroy timelines when we change things? That everything coexists? That's heretical.
I'm not preaching heresy.
Torque turned to face him.
The sector is indeed overwritten with new history. The other events are unhistory now, stuff that never happened. Plausible lies. Raw data that pops out of a wormhole mediated by a naked singularity, if you ask the theorists, causally unconnected with reality. But all the lies end up in the library. Not only does the library document all of recorded human history, and there is a lot of it, for ubiquitous surveillance technology is both cheap and easy to develop. It's how we define civilization, after all. It documents all the possible routes through history that end in the creation of the final library. That's why we have the final library, as well as all the transient, palimpsest-affected branch libraries.
It was hard to conceive of.
All right. So the library is full of internally contradictory timelines. Why can't I find what I'm looking for?
Well, if you're using your waypoints correctly, the usual reason why you can get a random selection of incorrect views is that someone has rewritten that sector. It's a palimpsest. Not only is the information you came here to seek buried in a near-infinite stack of unhistories, it's unlikely you'll ever be able to return to it, unless you can find the point where that sector's history was altered and undo the alteration.
Repeatedly killing the Buddha. Graduation Ceremony. You will awaken early on that day, and you will dress in the formal parade robes of a probationary agent of the Stasis for the last time ever. You have worn these robes many times over the past 20 years, and you are no longer the frightened teenager whose hands held the knife of the aspirant and whose ears accepted their ruthless first order. Had you declined the call, were you still in the era of your birth, you would already be approaching early middle age, the great plague of senescence digging its claws deep beneath your skin. And as it is, even though the medical treatments of the Stasis have given you the appearance of a 25-year-old, your eyes are windows unto the soul of an ancient. Your mind will be honed as sharp and purposeful as a razor blade, for you will have spent 6 months preparing for this morning. 6 months of lonesome despair following Torque's explanation of your predicament, spent in training on the roof of the world, obsessively focused on your final studies. You have completed your internship and your probationary assignments, worked alone and unsupervised in perilous times. Now you will present yourself to the examiners to undergo their final and most severe examination, in hope of being accepted at last as an agent of stasis. As a full agent, you will no longer be limited in your access to the library, nor will your license to summon time gates be restricted. You will be a trustee, a keyholder in the jailhouse of history, able to rummage through lives on a whim, free to search for what you have lost, or have had taken from you. As yet, you are unsure whether it was malice or negligence that destroyed your private life. You will dress in a saffron robe bound with a black belt of your current rank, and place on your head the beret of an agent aspirant. Elsewhere in the complex, a dozen other probationers are similarly preparing themselves. You will hang on your belt the dagger that you honed to lethal sharpness the night before, obsessively polishing the symbol of your calling. Before the sun reaches the day's zenith, it will have taken a life. It is your duty to ensure that the victim dies swiftly, painlessly. Out on the time-weathered flagstones, beneath the deep blue dome of a sky bisected by a glittering torque of orbital momentum transfer bodies, you will stand in a row before your teachers and tyrants. Not for the first time, you will find yourself asking if it was all worth it. They will stare down at you and your classmates, ready to pronounce judgment, ready perhaps to admit you to their number as a peer, or to anathematize and cauterize, to unmake and consign into unhistory those who are unworthy. They outnumber your fellow trainees 3-1, for they take the training of new you mortals very seriously indeed. They are the eternal guardians of historicity, the arbiters of what really happened. And for no reason you can clearly comprehend, they offered you, you in particular out of a field of a billion contenders, an opportunity. And there will be speeches, and more speeches, and then Superintendent of Scholars Manson will utter a sermon, along exactly the lines one would expect on such an occasion.
This momentous and solemn occasion marks the end of your formal training, but not the end of your studies and your search for excellence. You entered this academy as orphans and strangers, and you shall leave it as agents of the stasis, sworn to serve our great cause, the total history of the human species.
He's going to go on in like vein for nearly an hour, you realize. One homily after another, orthodox ideology personified. Theory before praxis.
We accept you as you are. Human aspirants with human weaknesses and human strengths. We are all human, that is our weakness and strength, for we are the agency of human destiny, charged with the holy duty of preserving our species from the triple threat of extinction, transcendental obsolescence, and a cosmos fated to unwind in darkness. Notwithstanding your weaknesses, you, Brother Chi Yun, with your obsessive exploration of the extremes of pain, you, Sister Gretz, with your enthusiasm for the fruit of the dream poppy. You, Brother Pierce, with your palimpsest family hobby. We understand all your little vices, and we accept you as you are, despite your weaknesses, despite knowing that only through service to the stasis will you achieve all that you are destined for.
You will not bridle angrily when Superintendent of Scholars Manson tramples on the grave of your family's unhistory, even though the scars are still raw and weeping, because you know that this is how the ritual unfolds. You will have reviewed the recording delivered in the internal post some days before, heard the breathy rasp of your own voice wavering on the razor edge of horror as he explains the graduation ritual to you in the present. Your fingers will whiten on the sweat-stained leather hilt of your dagger as you await the signal. Though outwardly you remain at peace, inside you will be in turmoil, wondering if you can go through with it. Slaying your grandfather, cutting yourself free from the fabric of history, was one thing. This is something else.
Stasis demands eternal vigilance, brothers and sisters. It is easier to shape by destruction than to force creation on the bowels of historicity. But we must stand vigilant and ready, if necessary, to intervene even against ourselves should our hands stray from the straightest of strokes. Every time we step from a time gate, we are born anew as information entering the universe from a singularity. We must not allow our hands to be stilled by fear of personal continuity.
You will realize then that Manson is on track. that he really is going to give the order your older self described with shaking voice, and you tense in readiness as you call up a channel to control, requesting the gate through which you must graduate.
"Weakness is forgivable in one's personal life, but not in the great work. We humans are weak, and sooner or later many of us stray, led into confusion and solipsism by our human grief and hubris. But it is our glory and our privilege that we can change ourselves. We do not have to accept a false version of ourselves, which have fallen into the errors of wrong thought or despair. Shortly you will be called on to undertake the first of your auto-surveillance duties, monitoring your own future self for signs of deviation. Keep a clear head, remember your principles, and be firm in your determination to destroy your own errors. That is all it takes to serve the stasis well. We are our own best police force, for we can keep track of our own other selves far better than any eternal invigilator."
Manson will clap his hands, and then, without further ado, he will add,
"You have all been told what it is that you must do in order to graduate. Do it. Prove to me that you have what it takes to be a stalwart pillar of the stasis. Do it now."
You will draw your dagger as your phone sends out the request for a time gate 2 seconds back in time and a meter behind you. Control acknowledges your request, and you begin to step toward the opening hole in front of you. But as you do so, you will sense wrongness, and as you draw breath, you will begin to turn, raising your knife to block with a scream forming in the back of your mind.
"No, not me!"
But you will be too late. The stranger with your face stepping out of the singularity behind you will tighten his grip on your shoulders, and as you twist your neck to look around, he will use your momentum to aid the edge of the knife you so keenly sharpened. It will whisper through your carotid artery and your trachea, bringing your life to a gurgling, airless fade-out. The graduation ceremony always concludes this way, with the newly created agents slaughtering their Buddha nature on the stony road beneath the aging stars. It is a pity that you won't be alive to see it in person. It is one of the most profoundly revealing rituals of the time travelers, cutting right to the heart of their existence. But you needn't worry about your imminent death. The other you, born bloody from the singularity that opened behind your back, will regret it as fervently as you ever could. The trial. The day after he murdered himself in cold blood, Agent Pierce received an urgent summons to attend a meeting in the late 19th century. It was, he thought shakily, par for the course. Pick an agent, any agent, as long as their home territory was within a millennium or so of the dateline. From Canada in the 21st to Germany in the 19th. What's the difference? If you were an inspector from the umpty millionth, it might not look like a lot, he supposed. They were all exuberant egotists, these faceless, teeming people who had lived and died before the technologies of total history rudely dispelled the chaos and uncertainty of the pre-stasis world. And Pierce was a very junior agent. Best to see what the inspector wanted. Kaiserin, Germany was not one of Pierce's areas of interest, so he took a subjective month to study for the meeting in advance. Basic conversational German, European current events, and a sufficient grounding in late Victorian London to support his cover as a more than usually adventuresome entrepreneur looking for new products to import, before he stepped out of a time gate in the back of a stall in a public toilet in Spittelmarkt. Berlin, before the century of bombs, was no picturesque gingerbread confection. Outside the slaughterhouse miasma of the market, the suburbs were dismal, narrow-fronted apartment blocks as far as the eye could see, soot-stained by a million brown coal stoves, the principal olfactory note one of horse shit rather than gasoline fumes. Although Rudolf Diesel was even now at work on his engines in a more genteel neighborhood. Pierce departed the public toilet with some alacrity. The elderly attendant seemed to take his emergence as a personal insult, and hastily hailed a cab to the designated meeting place, a hotel in Charlottenburg. The hotel lobby was close and humid in the summer heat. Blue bottles droned around the dark wooden paneling as Pierce looked around for his contact. His phone tugged at his attention as he looked at the inner courtyard, where a cluster of cast-iron chairs and circular tables hinted at the availability of waiter service. Sure enough, a familiar face nodded affably at him. Pierce approached the table with all the enthusiasm of a condemned man approaching the gallows.
"You wanted to see me," he said.
There were two goblets of something foamy and green on the table, and two chairs.
Who else? The other drink's for you. Berliner Weiss with Waldmeister syrup. You'll like it. Guaranteed.
Kafka gestured at the empty chair.
Sit down.
How do you know? Silly question. Pierce sat down. You know this isn't my time.
Yes.
Kafka picked up a tall, curved glass full of dark brown beer and took a mouthful.
Doesn't matter.
He peered at Pierce.
You're a new graduate. Damn, I don't like this job.
He took another mouthful of beer.
What's happened now? Pierce asked. I don't know. That's why I want you here.
Is this to do with the time someone tried to assassinate me?
No.
Kafka shook his head.
It's worse, I'm afraid. One of your tutors may have gone off the reservation. Observation indicated. I'm putting you on the case. You may need to terminate this one.
A tutor. Despite himself, Pierce was intrigued. Kafka, the man from Internal Affairs. But his role was unclear, for was it not the case that the Stasis police their own past and future selves? Wanted him to investigate a senior agent and tutor? Ordering him to bug his future self would be understandable, but this...
Yes.
Kafka put his glass down with a curl of his lower lip that bespoke distaste.
We have reason to believe she may be working for the opposition.
Opposition? Pierce raised an eyebrow. There is no opposition.
Come now, don't be naive. Every ideology in every recorded history has an opposition. Why should we be any different?
But we're... Pierce paused, the phrase, bigger than history, withering on the tip of his tongue.
Excuse me? Work it through.
Kafka was a twitch with barely concealed impatience.
You can't possibly not have thought about setting yourself up as a pervert god, can you? Everybody thinks about it. This we know. Seed the universe with life. Create your own science empires. Establish a rival interstellar civilization in the deep cryptozoic, and use it to invade or secede Earth before the Stasis notices. That sort of thing. It's not as if thinking about it is a crime. The problems start when an agent far gone in solipsism starts thinking they can do it for real. Or worse, when the opposition raise their snouts.
But I... Pierce stopped, collected his thoughts, and continued. I thought that never happened. That the self-policing thing was an adequate safeguard.
Lad. Kafka shook his head. You clearly mean well. And self-policing does indeed work adequately most of the time. But don't let the security theater at your graduation deceive you. There are failure modes. We set you a large number of surveillance assignments to muddy the water. Palimpsests all, of course. We overwrite them once they deliver their reports, so that future you retains no memory of them. But you can't watch yourself all the time. And there are administrative errors. You're not only the best monitor of your own behavior, but the best placed individual to know how best to corrupt you. We are human and imperfect, which is why we need an external internal affairs department. Someone has to coordinate things, especially when the opposition are involved.
The opposition? Pierce picked up his glass and drank deeply, studying Kafka. Who are they? Who do you want me to rat out? He wondered. Myself? Surely Kafka couldn't have overlooked his history with Ziri, now buried beneath the dusty pages of a myriad of rewrites.
You'll know them when you meet them.
Kafka emitted a little mirthless chuckle and stood up.
Come upstairs to my office, and I'll show you why I requested you for this assignment.
Kafka's office occupied the entire top floor of the building and was reached by means of a creaking mesh-fronted elevator that rose laboriously through the well of a wide staircase. It was warm, but not obnoxiously so, as Pierce followed Kafka out of the elevator cage.
The door is reactive, Kafka warned,
placing a protective hand on the knob. Hidden glands were waiting beneath a patina of simulated brass, ready to envenomate the palms of an unwary intruder.
Door, except Agent Pierce. General defenses.
except Agent Pierce with standard agent privilege set. You may follow me now.
Kafka opened the door wide. Beyond it, ranks of angled wooden writing desks spanned the room from wall to wall. A dark-suited iteration of Kafka perched atop a high stool behind each one of them, pens moving incessantly across their ledgers. A primitive visitor, one not slain on the spot by the door handle, or the floor, or the wallpaper, might have gaped at the ever-changing handwriting and spidery diagrams that flickered on the pages, mutating from moment to moment as the history books redrew themselves, and speculated about digital paper. Pierce, no longer a primitive, felt the hair under his collar rise as he pulled his phone, pulling up the number of rewrites going on in the room.
"You're really working control hard," he said in the direction of Kafka's receding back. "This is the main coordination node for prehistoric Germany."
Kafka tucked his hands behind his back as he walked, stoop-shouldered, between desks.
"We're close enough to the start of stasis history to make meddling tricky. We have to keep track of continuity. We can't simply edit at will."
Meddling with prehistory, before the establishment of the ubiquitous monitoring and recording technologies that ultimately fed the library at the end of time, ought to be risk-free. If a Neolithic barbarian froze to death on a glacier, unrecorded, the implications for deep history were trivial. But the rules were fluid, and interference was risky. If a time traveler were to shoot the Kaiser, for example, or otherwise derail the Ur-history line leading up to the stasis, it could turn the entire future into a palimpsest.
"The individual I am investigating is showing an unhealthy interest in the phase boundary between stasis and prehistory."
One of the desk-bound Kafkas looked up, his eyebrows furrowing with irritation.
"Could you take this somewhere else?" he asked. "I'm sorry," Pierce's Kafka replied with abrupt humility. "Agent Pierce, this way."
As Kafka led Pierce into an office furnished like an actuary's hermitage, Pierce asked,
"Aren't you at risk of anachronism yourselves? Multitasking like that, so close to the real Kafka's datum."
Kafka smiled sepulchrally as he sat down behind the heavy oak desk.
"I take precautions, and the fewer individuals who know what's in those ledgers, the better."
He gestured at a small, hard seat in front of it.
"Be seated, Agent Pierce. Now, in your own words, tell me about your relationship with Agent Scholar Yarrow. Everything, if you please."
He reached into his desk drawer and withdrew a smart pad.
"I have a transcript of your written correspondence here. We'll go through it line by line next."